you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Donald Jeffries back on the show. Of course, Donald Jeffries is a researcher and author. Among his several books are Hidden History, an Exposé of Modern Crimes, Conspiracies and Cover-ups in American Politics, and Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Donald is also the host of the weekly program I Protest, which is carried on the Truth Frequency Radio. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, that's, I guess, like I said, it's a weekly program, once a week, and I guess people can get it by subscribing to Truth Frequency Radio. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I think they can listen to it live, and if not, yeah, they can go, and ideally they would subscribe under my name and chip in a little money, and then I actually get a cut of that, so that's the only way I get paid. So if they, they want to support me, that would be nice.
And you've been doing that since the first of the year?
End of last year, I think.
End of last year, okay.
Yeah.
So how's that going? You like the weekly talking to people?
Yeah, it's good. You know, I mean, I've had some interesting guests. I had Cindy Sheehan on there. I had Jerome Corsi. Really proud of the fact I had Todd McMurtry, who was one of the attorneys for Nicholas Sandman, mm-hmm. you know, suing all the and he gave me pretty much an exclusive interview as far as radio shows. Susan Olsen, my friend that played Cindy Brady in the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, her, she's quite her politics aren't quite what you usually expect from someone from West Coast.
She's really sound. Her and I just hit it off. I mean, I don't agree with her on everything, but she's very interesting. So, but yes, I've had some interesting people, Gerald Talente, you know, people on there that very proud of.
Okay, well, good luck with that venture.
Thank you.
So, tonight, you sent me the manuscript or final copy, or I guess it's close to it. It's Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics?
Crimes and Conspiracies in America. Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics.
I'm sorry, yeah. Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics. The thing is, I cut and pasted it. I messed it up. Because I have it all in PDF form.
Right.
And this book is due out next month?
Yeah, next month. It's Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776-1963. It's basically a prequel to Hidden History. In fact, that's what I wanted to originally call it. The original title was Hidden History 2, the prequel, and then Crimes and Cover-Ups. But for whatever reason, the publisher thought it was better to leave the Hidden History 2 part out. So that's why the title is what it is.
Okay. So you cover chapters here. You have what? The Birth of the Republic. Chapter 2 is pre-1860, Jacksonian Democracy, takes us up to the Civil War, Lincoln assassination, post-Civil War America, Reconstruction, and these things. The so-called progressive era, I guess, 1900 to the 1920s, the First World War, the Federal Reserve Act, all the way up to the Great Depression. And so you selected a few figures or topics for this book, and let's go right into it. So why'd you write the book, and why'd you select the... Let's get into some of the figures or events that you talk about, you discuss in the book.
Well, I wanted to, you know, a lot of readers pointed out to me that, you know, this corruption started long before November 22nd, 1963, because Hidden History started with the Kennedy assassination, and it's basically the 50 years after that. They're basically a timeline of my life from what I had seen, and as far as a kind of uninterrupted timeline of corruption, of organized corruption. But I readily admit it, of course. You know, I know corruption goes way back. So I said, well, this is another book entirely. I mean, I had researched the Lincoln assassination for a long time, certainly Pearl Harbor, things like that. I became what I call awake on Lincoln when I started understanding that he wasn't the hero that I thought he was when I was a young guy, and like so many people. And the Founding Fathers, I mean, all those things. I thought there was a real story to tell there, because I think that Americans, by and large, are historically illiterate, and especially about older history. They really know very little, and what they know is basically Mick history, the fast food version that's served up, spoon-fed to them by Hollywood and the court historians, as I call them. And that's the ones that even read about it. But very few of them are, I think, familiar with many of the facts that are certainly about Abraham Lincoln and FDR and people like that that are sacred icons in our civilization. I tried to, you know, to show the real story. And I think that, by and large, history is written by the victors, as we know. And I think that the court historians have molded history into a malleable format that fits with the corruption of today. You know, George Orwell said, you know, he who controls the past controls the future, he who controls the present controls the past. And, you know, I think that's very profound, because if you can manufacture history, I mean, and it's not really even necessary to have convenient memory holes, as Orwell's Winston Smith had, changing facts on the fly and throwing old facts down the memory hole. We don't even have to do that, because what happens is the court historians, they agree on a narrative, and it's a narrative that fits in with their view of the world today. So therefore, the Founding Fathers have to be basically ignored, or basically smeared as old dead white racists, with the exception of Alexander Hamilton, who is the father of debt and the father of the central bank. And so he's more to their liking, and so he becomes a hip young black star on Broadway. But for the rest of them, they're old dead white racist, and they serve no purpose. So I just publishing their words, the kind of words that used to be taught in the schools, I think serves a purpose, and I think readers that will read it will understand. Wow, you know, Thomas Jefferson was the most enlightened man of his age, maybe of all ages. People like George Mason and Patrick Henry, John Hancock, these were brilliant men. George Washington, the Adamses, I mean, all over the place. These were, if there was ever such a thing as the greatest generation, it was the generation of the Founding Fathers.
It's hard to imagine Alexander Hamilton a rap star, but they apparently it's a big hit. They're pulling it up.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. And I'd like to see a poll done on how many, and it, I think, you know, I don't have very much confidence in the American population, but I really think a substantial number of the people that have gone to pay that kind of money to see that absurd play actually believe that he was black. I mean, I really think there are a substantial number of Americans that really would think that. And that's, you know, it may seem ludicrous on the surface, but I think Americans have been so dumbed down that the very fact that that kind of thing can become, I mean, if they made a play like that about Jefferson, it would be kind of ridiculous. But the idea that they can twist history like that and turn it into some kind of politically correct nonsense where the great the profound principles that are timeless that they fought for, of the consent of the government by the consent of the governed, liberty for all, and inalienable rights from God. I mean, all these kind of sacred concepts that are now just completely used to be cherished, but now they're just ignored. And as I pointed out, Hollywood hates the Founding Fathers. There's never been a single biopic ever done, even from the early silent days, on George Washington. He's supposed to be the father of our country. How does he never have a film devoted to him, even during the most patriotic era of Hollywood? Yet Alexander Hamilton had one. Andrew Johnson had one. Andrew Jackson's mistress had one. Why not George Washington? Why not Thomas Jefferson? Even Benjamin Franklin? It's obvious, because even then, the establishment didn't want to focus on their personalities, because their personalities are obviously a product of their beliefs and the revolution they fought. And they don't want the people to be reminded that at one time, the 1% of their days, of their era, certainly different from the 1% we have today, but these were all 1%ers, they were willing to risk, and they did risk. They lost their fortunes. Some of them died. They risked everything in the cause of liberty and to be independent from the tyranny of their day, which the King George's tyranny of that era is a walk in the park compared to the tyranny that the Americans are experiencing today and have been experiencing for the past several decades.
Yeah, I think King George III could ask, so how's that taxation with representation working out for you?
Yeah. What representation?
Well, that's another thing. You get an election fraud, right? That's effectively, yeah. We don't have representation, do we?
No, and just the taxation without, I mean, all the things that they wrote about, the slogans that used to be no taxation without representation. Well, I mean, does anyone think they have representation today? We certainly have taxation, but we don't have any representation. I mean, if there's so many issues that prove that, but my best example of that would be the banker bailout, mm-hmm. when 90-some% of Americans in every single poll opposed that. I don't know who the 5 or 6% that supported it were, but virtually everyone understood what a disastrous idea that was, yet every one of our political leaders supported. And we see that on all kinds of issues. It's like immigration, where obviously the vast majority of Americans understand the last thing we need are more immigrants. But again, our leadership constantly pushes it. And that's the dichotomy between what the general public, even with the cultural divide we have, still there's a general consensus on certainly things like the banker bailout and things like that. A lot of times, these foreign excursions, these absurd wars, there's still a general consensus on how wrong that is, and yet the leadership, our so-called representatives, always go against the wishes of their constituents. And I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers had in mind, and certainly no taxation without representation contradicts everything about our so-called representatives we have today.
Yeah, and no politician has campaigned on mass immigration or transplanting refugees or migrants from war-torn nations that are torn by wars that are fomented by NATO and the national security state and the oligarchs.
Right.
But no one, I don't think anyone in Minnesota voted to plant, 30,000 Somali refugees in Minnesota.
No, absolutely not. And I think that's the important thing to remember about the Founding Fathers today, and I try to point out in the book, is that if they were alive today, even Alexander Hamilton, although Hamilton was probably a member of the CFR, I would think, and he may fit in. Benjamin Franklin was also very, very complex, but I think they might be able to, he'd probably join today's version of the Hellfire Club, and he'd probably fit in. But the rest of them would be not welcome anywhere in the corridors of power. If they still had their fortunes, I guess they'd be private businessmen, but they would be smeared and branded as extreme right-wing extremists. They would be certainly not welcome anywhere near any mainstream media or anything like that. And I think it's really sobering to think of that, because these are the founders, and we still kind of sometimes pay kind of a general homage to them on July 4th and things like that, but we don't listen to their words. And certainly the media pays. I mean, certainly, when's the last time you heard anybody quote from George Washington's farewell address? They can't do that, because every single thing about his farewell address contradicts our so-called bipartisan foreign policy, which we've been conducting since the end of World War II. every single thing about it. So this is the founder of our country. So even sleeping sheeple Americans might begin to, you know, open their eyes and say, well, you know, George Washington, what's he talking about? That's, I haven't heard anything like that before. And same thing with, you know, Thomas Jefferson's the Tree of Liberty must be sprinkled with the blood of patriots and tyrants every 20 years or whatever, those kind of things. And there are tons of those quotes on the record. I wrote in the book, I tabulated, I was even surprised myself at how much is out there, easily accessible from all of the founding fathers, even the Hamiltons, that talk about the right to bear arms, the individual right to bear arms. There's no, I mean, the idea that people act as if, yes, they should have worded it differently. I wish they'd been a little clearer in the Second Amendment, mentioning militia and so forth, but there's no doubt about what they meant, because you just look at the comments, and I have many of them in the book for people to see. There's no question. Every one of those founding fathers was a diehard proponent of individual right to bear arms, and they would not have wanted any restrictions on that. And they all noted the main reason for that was because, you know, a fear of government. They had just, you know, broken away from what they thought was a tyrannical government. The last thing they wanted was to have a government tyranny imposed on them and not them not be able to theoretically fight it. So I think people just looking at that, and I'm not a real big guns right advocate guy, but there's no question. And when we look at so-called liberals today, and when they talk about, well, this is what they meant by that, and it's kind of it's not unclear at all. And the proof is in the pudding. If people read my book, they'll see the words of all the founding fathers, and they leave no doubt. They may have left doubt in the way they worded the Second Amendment, but there's no doubt and what they actually thought. And I think those are the kind of things it's important for people, Americans, to read and understand. And these are essential, you know, first sources. This is an actual source. This is not filtered through some court historian. And unfortunately, so much of what we know, just like the current events we consume, if we watch television, it's filtered through these talking heads, these multi-million-dollar talking heads who are basically state-controlled puppets, who are just reading you the news the way the Soviets used to read under TASS and Pravda. The only difference is the Soviet citizens at least were yes, sophisticated enough to understand this is state-run media. A substantial portion of Americans don't understand that when they're watching CNN and MSNBC, that they think that these are independent journalists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's self-evident. I mean, obviously, the Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights was passed to guarantee liberties that might be threatened by the government. So it makes no sense to pass an amendment saying that the government may keep and bear arms. I mean, that's self-evident. Right. I mean, it's a disingenuous argument. Yeah, it's a well-regulated militia is necessary for the preservation of a free state. Therefore, the right to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. And that's, that's just one of these things. I mean, that's another thing just through, I mean, obviously, if you leave the Constitution up to, you know, to be interpreted by lawyers and political appointed judges and these things, it's going to be interpreted in a way that serves the interest of the oligarchy, which it has. And that's one of the myths of America, is the myth of continuity, meaning that we still live under the same Constitution when it's been so ignored and manipulated that it bears no resemblance to the original plan, which was just a sort of a decentralized confederation of sovereign states that had created a common market and a mutual defense pact.
Exactly. And you know, I think that and I have the quote from Thomas Jefferson in the book, so many great quotes he wrote, where he counseled, he warned that forget the exact quote, but he's basically saying, you know, if it ends up that the Supreme Court is interpreting the Constitution, then we've gone down the wrong path. Well, John Marshall was the first activist. Once he decided, I'm just going to do this, and they let him. And for, again, people think that this is always as much as a separation of church and state. There's no Jefferson wrote about the separation of church and state in private letters. There's nothing in the con. And now, of course, there's no state. There's nothing in there about, a state run religion. The idea was freedom of religion.
Yeah.
Freedom from religion. But there's nothing. The separation of church and state is used basically to keep religion out of all public, well, not religion, to keep Christianity, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's to create a naked public square, which is filled with secular humanism, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's, and again, it's dishonesty in the way, and what happened, and basically just looking at history honestly, really up, and that's why so much of this book is focuses on Lincoln and that period, because I think that's the most significant period in our history. But it should be the Revolutionary period, and it was up until the Civil War. And I think if we look at the 15 presidents before Abraham Lincoln, except for James K. Polk, because I think the Mexican-American War was a wrong-headed move, and I write about that. That was a first inkling that something was going wrong, and it was allowed to happen, and I think it was a kind of a disastrous thing.
Mr. Lincoln opposed.
Exactly, which Mr. Lincoln opposed. Yeah, his words could have been said by any secessionist.
Yes.
Before the Civil War, they could be word for word. But other than that, the other 14 presidents, think of them what you will, as far as Federalists and Democrats, which was, that's the way things broke down at that time politically. All of them, not a single one of those presidents, even Andrew Jackson, who was kind of an activist president, and many things I admire about him as a populist against the bank and so forth, none of them really tried to exceed their constitutional bounds. Every one of them stayed within the limits of their power. And the legislature never has overstepped this. We're supposed to have a separation of power, the three equal branches of the government. The judiciary early on under John Marshall started to exceed their boundaries. And then the legislature, again, which should be, if any of the three exceeded their powers, I would prefer that it be legislative, because theoretically we have the most control over them. The House of Representatives, we can vote them out every two. We never do, because we reelect 96% of them every election. But we can do that with a president. It's every 4 years, and it's more of a handpicked thing. And he's kind of the entire executive branch, and the judiciary. Obviously, you can't vote them out. So, but what has happened is the legislative branch, especially starting with the Civil War, because once the war between the states happened, you had a president like Abraham Lincoln, who became the first imperial president. He invented the imperial presidency. He exceeded – I mean, I probably missed some things in writing about him. But he trampled on the Constitution so thoroughly. It was not even the piece of paper that George W. Bush scoffed at him being a century later. It was absolutely horrendous what he was allowed to do. The Congress permitted it, because they were run mostly by members of his party, the Radical Republicans, if anything, chastised him for not being tough enough and not being tyrannical enough. And the opponents he had there, like one of my heroes, Clement Vallandigham, who I wrote about in there, was later arrested in the middle of the night. And when Roger Stone was arrested, the pre-dawn raid at his house a few months back, it really rekindled memories in my mind of writing about the middle of the night arrest of a sitting congressman, Clement Vallandigham, who was not a Confederate. He was a Northerner who was opposing Lincoln's disastrous and bloody war, and his suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, and his trampling on the liberties of the people. And Lincoln being allowed to do this, and then winning — it's all about winning. Once that war was won, where they, Goliath defeated David thoroughly, and the Reconstruction period, basically, that is where real racism was born, is that Reconstruction period. It's where the KKK was born, things like that. And eventually out of that, because of the way, with heavy-handed nature of it, that's what happened. Then you had Jim Crow laws, separate but equal, and it festered, as Langston Hughes, the poet, would say. It was a dream deferred, and it did explode. And it about a century, about a century till the Civil Rights Movement, all of that would have been avoided if Lincoln had just had any kind of flexibility, if he had just allowed the original seven states to secede, go ahead and try to form their government. They almost certainly wouldn't have been able to do it within the continental United States, and they probably would have come right back to the Union. Instead, he just insisted on this heavy-handed approach and no flexibility. And the reader can you're going to get a perspective on this that you're not going to get in very many history books. But I'm not writing about some kind of mystical Father Abraham and filtered through what Thomas DiLorenzo, who was one of the first writers to expose the real Lincoln and wrote a book called The Real Lincoln that was highly influential with me, and also Lincoln Unmasked. But he calls the historians that fawn over this, he really has become the secular saint of our civilization. And it's probably fitting, considering the state of our civilization, that an absolute tyrant like this is considered our number one hero and our greatest president. But DiLorenzo calls the court historians and the tenured professors that fawn over him the cult of Lincoln. And it is a cult. It's a cult, and it's impossible, as he says, being a member of the cult of Lincoln means making an excuse for everything Lincoln did. And they do. They just, okay, suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Well, he had to. You know, he threw, who knows, 10,000, 15,000. Nobody even knows how many Americans were thrown into makeshift prisons for no other reason than opposing his war or opposing his policies. He shut down hundreds of newspapers. Well, he had to. I mean, everything he did, well, he had to do it. These were things that people don't even know. And I describe so many awful things came out. And I wrote an article called The Precedents, The Awful Precedents of Abraham Lincoln, which appeared in a new journal that's out now, a quarterly journal, The Garrison Journal, which my friend S.T. Patrick is publishing. And it's got some really good writers in there. And I was proud to have my work there. And I talk
about. Is that William Lloyd Garrison or Garrison, the DA in Louisiana?
Well, no, it's not. It's Garrison with one R, and I think it's just kind of like a Garrison and Arsenal. Or whatever.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay.
No, it wasn't named after a person. No.
Okay.
It probably would have been Jim Garrison if it was doing okay, those two. But it's just kind of an iconoclastic historical journal, and in that I just point out about I kind of go over a lot of his unconstitutional acts, and I talk about how. Because they were allowed to happen. And, the Supreme Court could do nothing because Lincoln tried to arrest the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court early on in his administration, and he actually was tempered a bit. And even his aides realized that was going a little too far, and he backed off. But because naturally he said, no, you just can't suspend the writ of habeas corpus. That's unconstitutional. But Lincoln didn't care. He didn't care that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. He said, hey, look, I'm the president. I'm the commander in chief. That was his line for everything. But because he was allowed to do this, shut down newspapers, throw civilians in jail, suspend the writ of habeas corpus, charge, keep people in jail for months, even years, makeshift prisons, no charges, including one of the people, one of the most ironic arrests he made was Frank Key Howard, who was the grandson of Francis Scott Key. And to make it even more ironic, he imprisoned him in Fort McHenry. The same fort where the Star Spurs grandfather wrote this talk about this, the flag flying over Fort McHenry. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But how many Americans do you think even know that? And it's what Lincoln did was tragic. And I think as Lord Acton, I have the quotes. One of my favorite Lord Acton, the guy who wrote "Power Corrupts Absolute," "Power Corrupts Absolutely." One of the great classical liberal minds of the 19th century. And of course, he wasn't corresponding with Lincoln or U.S. Grant. He was a friend of Robert E. Lee.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And he corresponded with him, friend, wrote some great letters back and forth. And I don't have the exact quote, but when the South lost, he said, "I weep for what was lost at Appomattox more than what was lost in Napoleon's time," or something like that. But
what was lost at Appomattox far exceeds what was won at Waterloo, or something like
that. Okay, yeah, something like that. Yeah. So. But even, that voice from England recognized how important this battle was because it really was a second revolution because the South, and again, I know I'm going to be criticized. Oh, my God, you're supporting slavery. No, I'm one of the few people out there that are talking about the 40 million slaves in the world today, including 10 million in India. And now no one seems to care about that. But certainly not a supporter of slavery. But the South was fighting for the principle of the same principle we fought the revolution for. They no longer consented to be governed under the central government for whatever reason. You can say it was because of slavery or states' rights or whatever, but it doesn't matter because the whole idea of our war for independence was that all people everywhere have a, even Lincoln had said things like that in the past. Jefferson certainly said it over and over again. The whole idea of America was that people have a right to consent to those who are governing them. And that's the whole, the freedom and liberty is based on that principle. Well, the winners, the victors that wrote this history fought against that principle. That's why H.L. Mencken, again, lots of people on the left like me, I'm ostensibly a classical liberal populist. People like H.L. Mencken, I have his quote in there. He analyzed the Gettysburg Address and said, and it is beautiful poetry, But he said nothing could be further from the truth or more ludicrous, because these are the people Lincoln's side was fighting against: government of the people, by the people, and for the people. He was trying to stop people from doing that. And so, but we sit there and we consider that the greatest political speech ever, even though it's a complete lie.
Well, whenever a politician or a lawyer invokes poetry instead of a logical argument, you know you're in trouble, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what fooled, because, I mean, Lincoln could come up with some wonderful poetic type phrases, you know, the mystic chords of memory, yes, the better angels of our nature. I mean, he had a great ability for that. And that's why I loved him like everyone else for a long time, until I started realizing, wait a minute, first of all, I wasn't really cognizant of all the tyrannical things he did, but the idea that our whole historical narrative is built on, okay, this is, and I have the quotes in there from some court historian that basically says, you know, George Washington led the troops to victory, and that's pretty much all they talk about in the Revolution. Abraham Lincoln saved the Union. You know, that FDR expanded it to, you know, to include everyone. And that's, it's that simplistic. That's really the way Mick history works. They pick out a few, and invariably, other than George Washington, who is still kind of considered a halfway hero, they just don't focus on his farewell address or anything too specific, but he's still considered a halfway hero. But Lincoln is when the real history with these people starts. And that's when, unfortunately, that's when I think that the Constitution is written, effectively was thrown in the trash, because it's never been followed since then. And certainly you can see even now, when anybody even mentions something about trying to become a strict constructionist of the Constitution, whatever, there's howls of outrage everywhere. They, oh, the Constitution's a living, breathing document. So what does that even mean? And you know, I've heard people like Chris Cuomo, you know, this mobster wannabe that's on television, that got on there and he talked about hate speech. You need to read the Constitution about the hate speech. Like, what? No, there's nothing about hate speech in the Constitution. What are you talking about? But this is what most people get. And that's why hopefully a lot of people will read my book, because it's going to be another side that they don't get. They don't get whatever little history is doled out to them is again, that fast food version of Mick history, where people kind of see, you know, and they get it mixed up in their head. You know, was Alexander Hamilton really a black rap star? Was Abraham Lincoln really a vampire killer? I mean, you know, this is really the level of historical knowledge that most people have. I mean, now they're, you know, even things like Woodrow Wilson, who was one of the first real globalist types of leaders in the White House, who pushed to, you know, are promising not to get us into World War One, did everything he could to get us into World War One, was pushing for the League of Nations that became the UN. He was really one of the first leaders that wanted world government. But because he came from the South and he showed Birth of a Nation in the White House, he's pretty much smeared now by the social justice warriors as a racist. So, I mean, it's impossible. And I have the quotes in the record going back to Lincoln, where Lincoln said things that would make the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan blush. And so did all the way up to Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, who gets great press still. And I'm convinced so much of this, as I point out, the reason why a lot of these guys get the press they do, Teddy Roosevelt, Lincoln, FDR, these were all warmongers. Yeah. Teddy Roosevelt was in many ways, the John McCainiac of his era. Now I will give him credit, like Andrew Jackson, he was willing to lead the charge himself. So he was willing to walk. He was a nut about war, but he was willing to actually go out there and risk himself. So you got to have a little respect for somebody like that. But to call him a progressive, and I have his statements on the record. I mean, he didn't go quite as far as, I think he even quoted Phil Sheridan, one of the great generals of Lincoln's generals, who said the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And Roosevelt basically agreed with that in so many words, and has awful anti-black rhetoric as well. But it's whether it's Margaret Mead, president of Planned Parenthood, people like that. All these people left what are definitely now considered racist comments on the record, they're swept under the rug. But somehow Jefferson, who really did not leave that kind of rhetoric on the record, somebody like a Jefferson is smeared as a racist, because it serves the purposes of the people in power. They want to not people to concentrate on Lincoln, on Jefferson's brilliance and his writings about liberty and, you know, things that, that uplift the human spirit. And people can realize what a, what an enlightened person he was. Instead, they want to channel this off and, oh, he was just a racist, so you don't pay attention to anything else he wrote. And they just ignore the things that Theodore Roosevelt especially said, something like, because, oh, he was a great progressive. Well, there's, I can't figure out anything he ever did that was progressive. And I've looked up his record, and like I said, he was pretty much – but these, this is what I write about in the book. I kind of look at these figures, and as far as I can determine, they've – almost every one of them that has a good if they have a good reputation with the court historians, by and large, they're somebody I don't admire and I think was working for the other side. The people that, other than maybe George Washington, because he still kind of has, for whatever reason, has a decent reputation. James Madison has a decent reputation. And, you know, really all the founders were wonderful, except Franklin was a little shaky, and obviously Hamilton, who the court historians love, because he was the father of debt. I mean, he invented debt. I mean, this is the guy that you talk about somebody they can love. I mean, you can see him headed for Broadway when he decided, hey, you know what? Let's have the federal government assume all the debts of the individual states after the war. Well, that's what they could love. And he invented debt, and he invented the concept of the central bank. And most people probably don't realize it, really, for the first several decades of the Republic, the overriding issue between the Democrats led by Thomas Jefferson and the Federalists led by the likes of Hamilton was that central bank and renewing the charter. Jeffersonians and later Andrew Jackson fought valiantly to stop that central bank because they realized the power of banks. And of course, eventually we all lost in 1913 with the Federal Reserve and fractional lending, which we still are shackled under today.
Think there will be a Broadway play in tribute to Aaron Burr?
No. Well, you know, Burr, you know, it would take kind of a kind of class like Gore Vidal, who wrote, you know, remember he wrote back when people read and more books were sold, he wrote the book Burr. He kind of really was the first person to really bring Burr into the mainstream as far as, because he was, Getty's been, and I don't think it's any accident he's been forgotten because he did kill Alexander Hamilton in a duel. And he was not really a friend of Jefferson, but he was theoretically on the Democrat side. And Burr is he had some kind of, skeletons in his closet, which a lot of these guys did as well. Maybe not literal skeletons like Benjamin Franklin. In the 90s, they discovered literal skeletons in his home in London. And I write a lot about that in the book. Yeah. That just kind of, I don't know how. I mean, I literally couldn't find any updates. And that's just amazing to me. They kind of glossed that over. I mean, this is, I don't know what it meant, but I don't know how they could determine very quickly that, well, he knew nothing about it. It was this young doctor who died unnaturally at a very young age. That was, how do you know that?
Like, was he in the spirit cooking?
Yeah. At the very least, especially considering he was involved with this Hellfire Club. Yeah. I mean, at least a skeptical person might say, wow, God, were there human sacrifices going on? Was he part of the child trafficking ring of his day? I mean, these are all questions that are legitimate to ask when you're part of a secret order, which he was.
But he was a libertine.
Yes, he was a libertine, and so there were orgies going on in the bowels underneath his monastery, where they had prostitutes dressed as nuns. So they certainly were. There was blasphemy going on. So, I don't think it's, again, you can't prove anything. I certainly wouldn't say, well, Benjamin Franklin definitely was involved in human sacrifice, but I would certainly say that it's very, interesting, if not suspicious, that, I mean, most people, I mean, how many houses do you find a bunch of human skeletons in? And, I think that, but it's amazing. And I have the reaction, I have the quotes from the people, and you could see there. And that's what I find writing about history that's most interesting, is that it doesn't matter how old the history is, that the court historians that are alive today, it's like they're all defending some twisted code of honor or something. And
human skeletons buried in the basement is more interesting than rumors regarding Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson.
Yes. I mean, wouldn't you think so? I mean, I would think that I would, even, not take aside the fact that I love Jefferson and admire him, but yeah, I think that's all. First of all, no matter what, the most damnable thing against Jefferson could be that if he actually did have children with us. And again, but people don't, when they look at Jefferson, they don't look at the big picture. They don't look at the fact, first of all, this guy was an honorable man. He lost his wife when he was still relatively young. And she really made a very selfish vow on her bed where she made him promise not to marry again. And, you know, that, I mean, I don't want to say anything against her. I mean, she died tragically young, but I think that's pretty selfish.
Until death do us part, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was selfish of her because that happened a lot. A lot of women died in childbirth then, and the men, you know, ended up starting second family. That was just the way it worked in those days. And a man of Jefferson's stature that certainly would have married again, had more children, but he was honorable. I think that's a good thing that he was able to probably suppress his own desires. So if he did end up having sex with Sally Hemings, and I'm not saying he didn't, but if he did, I don't understand. First of all, I think it was going on quite a bit, and it's understandable because in those, unless you were a member of the Hellfire Club, you know, I guess, in those days, free and easy sex wasn't available. And if you were forbidden to be married again, that may have been his only chance for, because presumably there weren't a lot of white women, especially of his class, that would be willing to just have an illicit affair with someone, I wouldn't think, at least openly. So I don't begrudge him that, if that was the case. But for whatever reason, they're looking to create villains and heroes. And I think most of the time when they create villains, they go after the more heroic people. And when they create heroes, the Lincolns and the Woodrow Wilsons and the FDRs, the Teddy Roosevelts, I mean, these are not my ideas of heroes. And I think that, again, history is written by the victors. And, you know, keep in mind who's writing this history and who's making out the heroes and the villains.
You also cover the influence of Freemasonry and also the anti-Masons. The one time was a conscious anti-Mason party in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have all the quotes from John Quincy Adams, who was the most high-profile anti-Mason party member out there, who had been a Federalist and became an anti-party, also the only president who ever became a member of the House of Representatives after he served in office. And I had a really newfound, just studying John Quincy Adams, I started liking both him and John Adams a lot more, even though I was certainly not a Federalist. But these were brilliant men. John Quincy Adams spoke seven languages. He was just an absolute – there's nobody in today's political stage that would be even close to being on an equal footing intellectually with someone like John Quincy Adams. And I was very impressed with what he wrote about the Masons. And I think he opposed Freemasonry on the same basis that everybody that did oppose it back then did, the oath of secrecy.
Yeah, yes.
The reason why I was raised a Catholic, the Roman Catholics forbid their members for a long time from becoming Masons.
Yeah, it was Humanus Genus, the encyclical Leo the 13th about Freemasonry.
Exactly. And, you know, so they didn't believe in secret oaths. And certainly if you remember, these are powerful people in government. If you're taking secret oaths, and if you're, I don't know how much is true, but if there really are these secret signals so that a defendant can be in court and a judge, you know, if you have to swear allegiance to your brother Mason over the law or anything else, I mean, that's not, you know. I mean,
there's a story when Santa Anna was defeated and he had surrendered, Sam Houston had him, and he was going to be shot. He reportedly signaled a Freemason hand sign and was set free and went on to live and prosper in the United States, I think in the chewing gum business.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and so it obviously had its advantages, but I think that most people don't know that, how big the anti-Mason party was for all, and the fact that it had something like a – I mean, just imagine today if a former president, Jimmy Carter or somebody, decided to become one of the leaders of, you know, the anti-whatever party, you know, anti-ecology party, something that would be really out of the mainstream. It's hard for us to imagine that.
Well,
but
I think what they were, I think, keen or aware of, and which people have been convinced through conspiracy theory, these things, you know, this is an old thing where anyone who's the importance of secret societies and political conspiracy and organizing, I believe, is in 1710 or 11, when the Freemasonry was started by the British. The Scottish Rite Lodge was taken over, and it was used as an instrument for British imperial power, for subversion and intrigue on the continent. It played a big part in the French Revolution, undermining the Catholic monarchy in France years later, decades later, in the 1780s and 90s. So they were aware that this was a method by which those who are political conspirators would organize, and they would, you know, they would network and communicate with each other and subvert governments this way. And, you know, this has also been shown, like, in later scandals regarding the Vatican Bank and the Freemasonic organization in Italy. Propaganda Due was more or less a parallel government. This isn't just fantasy stuff. This is also, you know, Freemasonic principles is the way how the organized crime, or at least the Italian mafia, organized, you know, in these things. So it's a way of organizing. So it is a concern, especially when you have the reality of secret oaths and the idea that government officials belong to secret societies where they have dual or conflicting loyalties. And this has been a problem throughout the United States, and our government being suborned and subverted by foreign interests. Through these secretive organizations.
And I think that it's important for Americans to realize, and I published it in this book, that this was not some kind of wacko theory where people just started to irrationally hate the Masons. They hated them because of the murder of Captain William Morgan, or a probable murder. They never found his body, who was a Mason, and people just thought that because he'd published a book, the proofs of the conspiracy or something about an expose on the Masons, and his body was never found, and people instantly suspected that the Masons had killed him to silence. Now, whether they did or not, I don't know. It certainly looks suspicious, but this wasn't just a theory that was by the extremists of their day. This is, again, something that eventually came to be spearheaded by John Quincy Adams, who was, you know, obviously as respectable a member of the 1% as there was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Anglican, old money guy who was a former president of the United States. So I think if people look at that and look at the quotes from him, no, that's not from some crazy anti-Freemason book. That's from a former president of the United States. So, and it's important. And I purposely try, when I'm writing about these kind of conspiracies, I really don't try. I don't want to point fingers at this group or that group, because I think they all can be utilized that manner. But somebody who grew up Catholic, I had kind of an instinctive aversion to Freemasonry because of the secrecy and the oaths, and the fact that if there is something like that, if it really is true, whether it's Santa Ana or anybody else, where if they can actually profit, especially if they're actually criminals in court, and if they can actually profit or with cops or whatever, and they can give little hand signals and get off, I think that, again, that just, you can't have an honest government or an honest civilization with that kind of group operating right in the middle of it.
Yeah, and it's also transnational in nature, so these organizations can infiltrate foreign governments, even ostensibly opposing sides. So you have, you know, false dialectics, or wars being conjured up. This is what we say: every war is a banker's war.
Yeah.
This is a method by which this would be achieved.
Right.
Alphabets like the Trilateral Commission or the Council of Foreign Relations sort of is organized under Freemasonic principles, as well as the various intelligence agencies.
And that's why, you know, Adam Weishaupt, who the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, who a lot of people think the Illuminati, that's the one organization where everything, you know, that's the umbrella they all come under. A lot of people that are really into conspiracies believe that. And, you know, his idea, his concept, and I have a lot of his quotes in the book, too, that this is obviously this was not some kind of, I love Jefferson, but Jefferson fell for Weishaupt. And he, as a free thinker and somebody who was skeptical of organized religion, Jefferson looked at him as a kindred spirit. And I think, oh, this is great. You know, he's trying to, you know, he's trying to make people less, suspicious and, backwards thinking. And he's trying to open people's minds. And, but if you look at Weishaupt's actual quotes, he talks about basically, there's a quote there basically saying, hey, you know, if you're going to be a member of our order, you got to be like Brutus, you know, you're going to be willing to assassinate, apparently, what he's saying. And his idea was to use the Illuminati where basically where they were infiltrating Freemason lodges all across the world. And then later, if the Illuminati considered to exist, which a lot of people think they did, then when all these other groups started, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, Skull and Bones, all these things where people kind of think of them as, you know, dens of, you know, vice and conspiratorial subterfuge, that kind of stuff. If you had one organization operating all, whereas I think Weishaupt's idea was that you would not even know you were in the same organization. You may be recruited by someone into a lodge or some other group, but you would not necessarily know because someone else will be recruiting, and it would all be at the behest of the Illuminati, but they'd all be working unbeknownst to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was kind of a brilliant, albeit evil, idea, but it certainly was a way to, if you were going to have a worldwide conspiracy run by one group above it all, that would be the way to do it. So apparently, you know, I still think there's some force above everything that's controlling all the darkness that rules the world. And whether it's the Illuminati in name or not, I don't know. But there's certainly a lot of evidence to, I think that, you know, even today when we look at our politics and we see the infighting between, you know, the CIA and the FBI and things like mm-hmm. that. Is there any doubt they're both working for the same force that's, you know, against the interest of the people? Definitely. And I think that's so Weishaupt created a monster that he might have unleashed upon the world back then. And I think that really that was the real birth. If you look at it, I definitely had to write something about the Illuminati and Weishaupt, because I think that's when people talk about conspiracies and all the stuff I write about. It goes back to where most people think it probably began, at least a modern version of it, with Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati.
Yeah, and this whole promotion of sort of extreme liberty. Coaxing or tricking people into thinking that by supporting libertinism and extreme liberty, you're actually freeing yourself, and actually you're in the final analysis enslaving yourself. Because if you're given to libertinism and lack of self-control, if you lack internal controls, it has to be compensated with external controls.
Right.
And we see that kind of going on today, right? You know, where
yeah.
you know, where people no longer have, you know, structural families, where these things are ostensibly voluntary associations or commitments and obligations with each other, unwritten laws. And because of the breakdown in the social order, we have, you know, expanding bureaucracies, red tape, a ridiculous, almost, you know, rules regarding dating and things like that, because
yes.
you know, the general rule, the traditional rules have been smashed. Now there's a reaction to that, and that's even harsher than anything that they could have imagined a century ago, you know?
Yeah.
You write about the trial of Lincoln's, the conspirators to kill Lincoln. That's a good example. Sort of, Lincoln, you know, his effect after his death, how they violated all procedure and all law in that case, right?
It was really a continuation of what had been happening during the war, where there weren't any. If there had been any trials, it would have been military tribunals. And so, although these defendants, the war was over, so there was no reason in the world why they didn't get a legitimate trial, but they didn't. Because again, already the radical Republicans had taken over, and the idea most people believe, and it's ironic really that Lincoln is their excuse is made for all his tyrannical actions while in office, and the disastrous policies and these unconstitutional actions that created the imperial presidency and set the template for future tyrannical imperial presidents to come.
Yeah, I mean, it was a military tribunal when courts were in session, and they tried yeah. civilians.
Yeah, exactly. So,
which we would see later on, like with the War on Terror, right?
At least
the suggestion that this could be done, yeah.
Right, and I think that really the next example of it, I think, we had the trial of the Lincolns, of the so-called conspirators, which included Mary Surratt,
mm-hmm.
was the first woman ever hung in American history, and it was a middle-aged woman that owned a boarding house and was guilty of nothing. And I put, you know, everything, all the evidence in there. I mean, the fact that they could hang her. And I think even I put the guy that lived for a long time, the actual hangman, she was led up the stage. She said, like, her too. You know, everyone thought that Johnson or someone would commute her sentence. That they didn't. And it was really a shameful day because they didn't get to, and really there's doubt about all of them because the government story was absurd on its surface that, Lewis Payne, and I'm really indebted to the late Dave McGowan, mm-hmm. who wrote some great stuff on the Lincoln assassination, never really finished it before he died. But, he had you thinking, we don't know what, if anything, really happened. I mean, yeah, he had me thinking that Lincoln's death was hoaxed. I mean,
he points out a lot of problems.
Yeah. I mean, really, I mean, the attack, I always thought, Lewis Payne, this huge, big, really good looking guy. And he points out the mug shots that these people took, especially Lewis Payne's. It looks like an early day Hollywood shoot. I mean, I don't know what they were going for there, but this guy was supposedly a presidential assassin. And they hired the top photographer of the day, Timothy O'Sullivan, I believe, or was Alexander Garner, one of them, that took those photographs. And, they're very, very strange looking photographs.
John Wilkes Booth's brother save the life of Lincoln's son?
Yes, yes, yes. He did. He grabbed him. He fell off a platform at Union Station or something.
That's
an
odd coincidence, right?
Oh yeah, very, very odd coincidence. Yeah, I mean, history's full of those kinds of.
In this case, we no one says when you talk about the Lincoln assassination, no one calls you a conspiracy theory because the official narrative is a conspiracy theory.
Exactly.
Because there's Knights of the Golden Circle. This ties back into this group up in Montreal, which ties back to the Rothschilds.
Yeah, and they hung conspirators. So I mean, they're their own theory. But I think that I believe what Otto Eisenschimmel, who wrote the first critical works, kind of the Mark Lane of his day, mm-hmm. wrote Why Was Lincoln Murdered in the Shadow of Lincoln's Death. I've read them. I got their old books, but they're hard to get, but they're worthwhile. And he really did some investigating, unlike the reporters and the court historians of his day. And he pointed the finger at Edwin Stanton, who was Lincoln's Secretary of War, a really diehard radical Republican, just a complete nut who I think would have wanted to exterminate the South like most of the radical Republicans wanted to do, and really a strange and bizarre kind of psychopathic figure personally. He just was a very, very strange, creepy guy. I think he spearheaded an internal conspiracy, an inside job, if you will. And I think for whatever reason, and I'm not really sure, I think the idea is that maybe they didn't trust Lincoln to be hard enough on the South, and that Reconstruction, which is ironic considering how hard he was as a president, but still he never was quite hard enough for the most radical of Republicans. And I think the most likely thing is that an inside group led by Stanton, Lafayette Baker, who was who also died a very strange, unnatural death later himself. Naturally, that's what seems to happen to these guys. Mm. I believe they were the spearhead. He was like the head of what would be the Secret Service early on. I think they spearheaded an inside plot to kill Lincoln and to make sure that the South would be dealt with in a heavy-handed way. And they thought Andrew Johnson would be more malleable. But I mean, you have so many things left that cried out for. I mean, John Wilkes Booth leaving a calling card at Andrew Johnson's hotel that day. Are you at home? Don't wish to disturb you, J. Wilkes Booth. That would be like Lee Harvey Oswald leaving a calling card for LBJ. I mean, just very things that cried out for real investigation. And as I point out, most people don't realize that while Lincoln has gotten great press, obviously, and all his flaws are glossed over, and he's the greatest man that ever lived, Father Abraham. His wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, is kind of portrayed as this shrewish, crazy, unbelievable, the most jealous woman in the world, who is really a complete nut, and was eventually committed by her own son, the only son, after the assassination. But I think she comes off better in my mind than her husband does, and I look at her very much like Marguerite Oswald. Much as Marguerite Oswald was the first conspiracy theorist in the Kennedy assassination, Mary Todd Lincoln, if you look at her, was the first conspiracy theorist there. She was the one that was saying, I write a lot of letters. She had, sure as you and I sins here. Johnson had a hand in all this, and she was pointing a finger at the policeman, John F. Parker, who was Lincoln's only protection that night, who left his post and ironically was suggested for the job by Mary Lincoln herself, another one of those curious twists. But so I think that's a way that, again, the court historians, they look at somebody who I think should have been portrayed as a more sympathetic figure, and she wasn't. And I feel badly for Mary Lincoln, because she ended up, she lost three of her sons early on, two of them very young, one of them, of course, in the White House, that had a profound impact on Lincoln himself, too. But when she lost Tad, the only son she had left was Robert Todd Lincoln, who went on to become this, you know, bureaucrat, deep state swamp creature of his own. He ended up serving in a bunch of administrations. He became literally a fat cat one percenter that made, you know, tycoon type. And he ended up committing his own mother. I just think that's despicable to do. And I sympathize with her on that. So again, I realize when I'm writing against the grain about, and I'm not purposely setting out to say, okay, well, this one has a good reputation with the court historians, so I'm going to go against them. And this one has a bad reputation, I'm going to support them. But it just kind of works out that way. When I look at the record, and I just end up, you know, saying, wow, the court historians really have it wrong on everything. And I just think that much as the so-called journalists today distort current events for the masses, I think that the court historians distort completely history for the few people left in America that actually read history books.
You write about the creation of the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve Act. And this was, this was part of that year. 1913 was a sort of a revolutionary year, because this is the same year that the Federal Income Tax was passed. Also the year that I believe it was the 17th Amendment,
direct election of senators.
So this is fundamentally changes. They create the central bank, although it's the way it's designed, it's not a central bank, because it has, you know, it's 12 regions, but it is a central bank. So this is an important landmark piece of legislation, although it isn't unconstitutional, because they didn't amend the Constitution to create this monstrosity. It is passed a law.
Yeah. And again, it was basically an outgrowth of the national bank that they had allowed to exist in the previous century. And they ended up perfecting it to their liking, and all the, you know, the when they gathered at Jekyll Island, all these big bankers, and they got together, and it was, you know, Charles Lindbergh's father, who was a congressman at the time, warned at the time of what would happen with something like this, and sure enough, they were right. And it took, you know, it was a good 20 years or so with the advent of the Great Depression for people like my hero Huey Long. He was one of the first critics of the Fed, and he recognized early on what it was. And it would take even longer than that until Eustace Mullins came along. Ezra Pound, you know, one of our political prisoners during World War II, the great poet, that was thrown in an outdoor cage for months and ended up being sentenced to St. Elizabeth's mental institution for a decade because he opposed World War II. And again, we think we have freedom in this country. This was a great literary figure. This was not some obscure guy, and he clearly had no mental issues at all, other than he wasn't thinking the proper way, you know, as far as our foreign policy during World War II. But Eustace Mullins wrote the first book on the Federal Reserve, where people could understand what was going on there. Now, those of us that are awake to the fraudulent, counterfeit nature of our banking system understand that whole fractional system that the Federal Reserve is based on allows legalized counterfeiting, and they allow all these loans to take place where 90% or more of the principal doesn't exist, 100% of the interest obviously doesn't exist. So it's a Ponzi scheme unlike any other that has ever been devised. And trying to get the American people to understand it is not easy, because I think they can't grasp the concept that something like that could be happening. And that, you know, when they go and they don't pay their credit card on time, or they don't pay a mortgage, that, you know, these are all tyrannical actions by these organizations, because in every case, they didn't risk their money. They risked a tiny fraction of their money to give someone a loan. And if you made a couple payments, they probably ended up making, you know, coming out ahead on it. But people don't understand how that works. And I don't know that Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson ever foresaw that fractional lending would become a reality, and that you would actually be having banks. They didn't want to give power to banks, but I can't believe that they really even could have conceived of something as evil as what the Federal Reserve became, where you actually have a private corporation, although it has the federal in the title, so people are fooled into thinking it's a government thing. It's not. That can create money out of thin air. It is legalized counterfeiting.
Yeah, I was listening to I think it was a Ken Burns series on Prohibition, which you talk about in your book, Prohibition. And there was a meeting in Atlantic City in 1928 or 1929 when all the head honchos, the crime bosses, were trying to organize things, keep things from getting too violent, and try to sort of create an effective cartel and keep things organized. As we all know how they're trying, we see this portrayed in movies a lot. And one of they wanted to design a nationwide system, and they wanted to break it up into 12 regions similar to the Federal Reserve System, which I thought was an interesting comparison.
Sure. They, a lot of these things are done symbolically, but you know, the book. This was an ambitious project because I started from the Revolution, and I go all the way up through the late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time in the World War II era. And again, I know I'm going to be attacked for being pro-Confederate when I'm just simply talking about the Northern policy of scorched earth and total war, which was unprecedented up at that time. And general psychopaths like William Sherman, who is one of the things I'm most proud of in the book is I found a letter that, I mean, I didn't find it literally. I found it online somewhere, but I'm sure it didn't make Ken Burns' a series on the Civil War. It wouldn't quite fit into that agenda. But Lieutenant Thomas Meyer is a Union troop, and people just read it. That's the kind of evidence that a court historian can all they can do is throw that down a memory hole because they can't explain it. And he delineates the graft, the literal theft.
Is this the one where he talks about watches?
He says general, and he kind of bemoans the fact General Sherman is getting such a cut. He says General Sherman's got enough gold and silver to open a bank. These were common thieves, and then at the end he says something like, "Don't let this be seen out of the family." I think he realized how it might look, but obviously that letter came down to us, and clearly this was widespread, and we know that that there was theft, there was rape. I've got tons of evidence that I show in there from sources at the time that talk about all the slave women that were raped by Northern troops. And I don't really know why they always picked or mostly picked on the slave women. Maybe some kind of twisted chivalry where they thought maybe the white women were above that or so. I really don't know. But it was done repeatedly. They violated slave women over and over again. They burned crops. They salted fields, so even after they left, they couldn't grow there again. They raised houses. They left the women and children that were there and old people that were there. All the boys were out in the field that were left try to fight valiantly against a much larger, more powerful foe. They just terrorized these people, and they made a hero out of this guy Sherman and his Sheridan, U.S. Grant. These are people that committed atrocities that are just unspeakable. And I don't know what the Confederates might have committed atrocities. I don't know. But I can't believe they could have been on. And even if they did, they've been documented by court historians. So I'm trying to write hidden history, and I'm trying to show the other side of the story here. And as I write in his memoirs, Sherman talked about, Honest Abe, this kind-hearted Abe Lincoln, who we're told is so pained by the war and the suffering. When he was talking, he went and recounted Lincoln wanted to hear stories of the women and children he encountered on and what happened to them as he marched to the sea. And Sherman talks about Lincoln laughed uproariously at those tales. So I what that says about Lincoln, I don't know, but it doesn't sound like something the kind of personality he's been depicted to have by the court historians. And because all this was swept under the rug, and that this total war, scorched earth policy, which extended to prisoners. And again, not only did they have this unfair, unconstitutional military trial of Lincoln's supposed conspirators that assassinated him or helped John Wilkes Booth assassinate him, not only did they do that, they hung Captain Wirtz of Andersonville Prison, who I have the evidence in there. By all accounts, this guy was a fair-minded, decent guy. He ran a prison. How could he hope to feed his prisoners when they were burning the crops all throughout the South? They couldn't feed the troops. The families were starving. How could they possibly have been feeding Northern prisoners? They had no food to give them. They couldn't even feed the guards. And yet he was hung for that. And that set the precedent that we would see come to fruition. Because up until that point, no one had ever thought of legally doing something to a vanquished foe after a war. Once a war was over, the war was over. You negotiated the terms. You didn't try to legally, you know, execute them or try them. Well, we carried it one step further with the Nuremberg trials. Yeah. And I know I don't know when the last person was, probably Robert Taft, I guess, you know, that talked about how disheartening the Nuremberg trials were. But now everyone on the left and the right quotes it as the ultimate brand of justice. Well, people will get the other side of the story there, and I have all the stuff, the great stuff John F. Kennedy wrote. Young John F. Kennedy, who recognized how beyond the pale this was, and in fact, people don't realize that one of the reason he named Senator Robert Taft, who was a Republican and a great man too, a great, great guy. The country would have been way different if he had been elected president instead of Eisenhower. But Taft opposed and was the strongest voice opposing these Nuremberg trials. Lots of people did on the left and right. Both of Eisenhower's brothers did. There are lots of people that did, including John F. Kennedy. But John F. Kennedy used Taft and cited him as one of his examples of profiles in courage in his best-selling book because of his stance against the Nuremberg trials. How many people do you think know that now? I don't think very many people do, especially Kennedy fans. So I'm just trying to point out that, and when you look at how the trials were conducted, again, who thought of this? This is an after-the-war thing. And what was really, really ridiculous about it is not only did they find some showcase Nazis to hang, others to imprison, to Rudolf Hess, who was really the peacenik among the Nazis, who was guilty of nothing more than early in the war, trying to crash land his plane for a peace mission with England to try to avert war. For his troubles, he was the lone prisoner in Spandau Prison for decades, one of the greatest examples of cruel and unusual punishment I've ever heard of. But again, people, he was a Nazi, so all things are fair, I guess, in love and war with Nazis. But the people that some people escaped for instance, nobody, none of the Japanese, faced war crime trials. It was Emperor Hirohito, I believe, one of those guys lived for decades afterwards in relative comfort. And you had other Nazis like Wernher von Braun and many others who became ushered into this country under Operation Paperclip and founded NASA and enjoyed decades worth of respectability. So it's a story that people ought to scratch their heads over. It's like, wait a minute, why were some Nazis allowed to come in and help build our intelligence apparatus and others were executed? Why were they executed? The war was over. No victor had ever done this before. So I think we ought to really look hard at what, but again, we're looking at now, what are we looking at down the road? I mean, we hasn't been that long ago where we had an administration that was defending torture as a practice, waterboarding, and you still have lots of people. I think Donald Trump probably likes that think it's okay. So I know this is a hard sell at this point, but I think that morally speaking, what we did in those two wars, especially those two good wars, and that's why I focus so much attention on the war between the states and the Second World War, because we have become indoctrinated with this idea that both of those wars especially were good wars. And one of the greatest things Benjamin Franklin ever said that is very seldom quoted is that there is no such thing as a good war or a bad peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you write about in the book, and it definitely makes the war much more morally ambiguous than what the received narrative is. Yeah, Nuremberg, you had coerced testimony, perjured testimony, these things, and we know about it now. You have, you know, the so-called the Rhine-Meadow death camps that Eisenhower ran.
Yes.
When there, much like there's no excuse for that, is you can make an excuse, or you can understand how conditions in the German camps were so bad, given the state of affairs in Germany in 1944 or 45, and that can be a partial, at least a significant explanation for the conditions discovered in the camps, particularly by the Allies in the West, like Dachau, Dachau and Belsen, these things. But same thing with Andersonville. The South had no economy; it was collapsing. Nevertheless, the conditions in the northern camps weren't much better. And the same thing with the Allies in the post-war era. The millions of Germans that were starved to death under a partial implementation of the Morgenthau Plan.
Yes, exactly.
And
talk about, I mean, talk about a diabolical plan. Mm-hmm. But going back to the Andersonville and prisons like that, most people, again, don't realize the South throughout the war kept trying to pray. They didn't want prisoners of war. They kept trying to trade prisoners with the North. The North, Grant wouldn't do it. And at one point, Wirtz, who, again, comes off very heroically in my mind, he actually made certain that his prisoners were shipped under Confederate armor. They were shipped down to Florida, to a portion of Florida where it was run by the North. And they were dropped off there. Well, the Northern troops went nuts, and Grant ordered them returned immediately. They said, look, just take them. We don't even need our prisoners in return. And they wouldn't do it because we can't feed them. And they were actually being humanitarians. They thought, hey, look, this is not right. We can't feed these people. But again, how many Americans know that?
Yeah.
Did they know that happened and said, oh, my God, they were terrible. Look at those awful pictures of the emaciated skeletons at the prison. And how can human beings do this? They don't look at the big picture. And obviously, as you mentioned, as far as Germany, there's I didn't go into the Holocaust or anything like that, because I realized that's really, really a controversial thing. And I think I had plenty of material beyond that, but suffice to say, I think that people need to be more skeptical, and they are skeptical about some things. They roll their eyes now. They understand the weapons of mass destruction thing, and they recognize the Gulf of Tonkin. Mm-hmm. They may even recognize other things I read about the book, Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain, the sinking of the Lusitania, even Pearl Harbor. They recognize these false flags. Well, just be a little the babies in incubators from the crying girl for the Iraq war. They understand how this works, and yet they fall for it over and over again. And for some reason, in those two wars, they are unwilling. They just turn off their critical faculties. People that can be skeptical about everything else, they refuse to be skeptical about the North in the war between the states and the Allies, even though they know we bombed Dresden and destroyed a beautiful city. And the statistics on that is incomprehensible. Something like 38,000 toddlers killed or something. Just incomprehensible statistics of what we did there. And it was mainly through the Royal Air Force. It was mainly a British-led thing. And Sir Arthur Bomber Harris was the leader of that. And he refused to apologize decades later. And he was, I was proud of it. Well, I don't know what you were proud of. And most people may not realize that that's where one of my favorite writers, and I think perhaps the last great writer America will ever have, Kurt Vonnegut, got his start, wrote Slaughterhouse-Five about his experience.
That's why I first heard about Dresden was
Slaughterhouse-Five. Yeah. Exactly. So, but it's just, you know, people instead, want to believe a cartoonish, cardboard villain type of version of history, where in the Civil War, which is never called the War Between the States, you have these snarling, tobacco-dripping, vile, white racists who are walking around with a whip and whipping everybody constantly and mistreating their property, which they consider them property, that would make no sense, raping and pillaging, and then, you know, the Nazis were literally anything can believe. Were they making lampshades out of human skin? Were they there's nothing you can say about that. Were they're still making science fiction movies where their Nazi scientists are working to create zombies and things. I mean, it's all still there because
Nazi zombies. Like, wait, if it's a zombie, I can be a conscious Nazi.
Exactly. Well, even in the world of comic books, Star Trek, everything.
Yes.
They go to Nazi planets. It's just.
They're building a memorial. right beside the British Parliament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's
lest we forget.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's so if we continue, I just would urge people to have skepticism and remember that propaganda, that the history is written by the victors. So the people writing the history of World War II are the people that won World War II.
Well, what's funny is that you look at these things, the historiography of these events, they change with the contemporary politics,
mm-hmm.
meaning that the Civil War became all about slavery in the 1960s. Now, why is that?
Right, exactly.
And World War II became all about the Holocaust in the 1970s when you have sort of this era of, I call it Jewish ascendancy.
Yes,
neocon era and these things. So now it's all about, you know, so...
And it was really, I don't really think it was called the Holocaust until you had that series, I guess.
1978.
Yeah, and it was where that's when it became known as that. And you know,
Winston Churchill didn't even write about it in his memoirs.
Exactly, and neither did Eisenhower. And again, I don't know what that means. And again, I understand, having kind of debated that a little bit in the past, that people get so emotional about it. And you're just accused of hating Jews if you do that. So yeah. I'm trying to look at the big picture, and all I'm saying is that
don't deny people their villains, Donald.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just, you know, just be, understand that every one of these figures, whether it's Adolf Hitler or Saddam Hussein or whatever, are these are the hobgoblins. What H.L. Mencken said, the American public is fed, you know, an endless series of hobgoblins. And that's what we are being fed. And still, it's just Hitler is the number one seed. And he's apparently never going to be knocked off that number one status.
Well, if Hitler is guilty for waging aggressive war, and therefore guilty for all the crimes that emerge from those things, and that's a reasonable argument. What about the guilt of the U.S. government since World War II?
Exactly. Yeah, well, again, whatever, and again, Hitler, there's so much more to Hitler. There's, you know, there's Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. Wall Street and the Rise of the Bolshevik Revolution. Hitler had, and I don't believe for a second Hitler killed himself in the bunker. I think he went to Argentina. I think the evidence shows that. And I don't know how long he lived, but I think we've been, you know, that Hitler was almost essentially a designated loser, WWE type of thing, where he was, because, I mean, a lot of his stuff, from a strategic point of view, made no sense. I mean, going into Russia at the time he did, and really, if Hitler had died or gone out of power before he inexplicably kind of invaded Poland, that's when he kind of shifted gears, because up until that point, he was revitalizing the economy, which is the Great Depression.
Yeah, he was like a Bismarck.
Yes, he would have been considered Germany's greatest leader and would have been considered a great world leader. Now,
there might be a Hitler in North Dakota, right?
Yeah, that's right. There you go, yeah. And that's where you... You start thinking, okay, that's where the conspiracy theory kicks in, is that, you know, what made him suddenly kind of go off in this, you know, this tangent where it looked like he was just trying to take over countries?
Because his banker was a chummy with the head of the Bank of England.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that he...
Shocked. Who was, yeah. You know, who was... And so he was, I believe, a Mason, by the way, even though Hitler regime supposedly had purged Masons.
Right, exactly.
So you have that intrigue where Germany could be maneuvered into war, you know,
but I think you know that you, so you have to be careful with so many people, especially those who side with the underdog, end up worshiping Hitler, and they look into this, okay, this is great. And I try to stay away from all that,
because, well, that's the idea, yeah. because they're exposing Allied atrocities or British subterfuge or perfidious Albion, as they call it. So
right.
Definitely. So then Hitler has to be good.
Yeah, and this is to say, you know, anything that I write about in this book is got nothing to do with trying to say Hitler was great, or, you know, that he was a great guy, or I would have been rooting for him or anything like that.
Well, you know, if you point out 38,000 toddlers were
burned
to death at Dresden, would you like Hitler?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, but that's the kind of reaction you get. Yeah. It's like, well, no, it just is. I don't support slavery, but because. You know, Sherman was, you know, raping and pillaging and stealing, and, you know, had this incredible graft operation where he became a very rich guy from stealing people's property and burning their crops and who knows how many.
Well, I don't know what people think was going on in the factories in the north.
Yeah.
But it's far more brutal than was going with, you could argue it's far more brutal, you know, treatment of people than was occurring in the south, if you're just.
Exactly. And people, yeah. Again, and I think what I
or trying... it was done to the Irish, for Pete's sake.
Exactly. Well, like, but again, it's, I think that's why to slavery today, which dwarfs anything. I think it was 3 million or so slaves in America at its peak. The 40 million slaves in the world today, and including 10 million in India, which is more than three times the amount America ever had, why there's no attention paid to that is because the unfortunate fact is almost all of those slaves are in non-white countries. And I think that's the problem, is that the narrative always has to be that this is whitey's fault. And so this is why we can't say, well, this is something. And so they actually tried to fool Americans into thinking that slavery was something that was unique to the American South.
Slavery is always a white thing, because the white people are the only ones who were asked to apologize for it.
Right.
And although the Arab slave trade was far more brutal. You know.
Yeah, and obviously anywhere slavery exists, there's no such thing as good slavery, but I just really object to it. And again, I think that's why what I'm writing, this kind of revisionist history, is so dangerous to the establishment, is because, again, it skewers one of the main narratives that they have going on. I mean, how many movies still are made in Hollywood where they're trying to push this slavery nonsense, where they're still trying to get blacks riled up and, you know, about something that happened 150 years ago. And it's constant, and it's done. I think there's a reason why it's done. So if somebody tries to expose the brutality of the people that were supposedly the good guys in this war, well, that can't be allowed to happen. And that's why, like I said, the court historians are so vested in these narratives. During the course of writing this book, I spoke to the great-great-great-great-great-grandnephew of Meriwether Lewis and the great-great-great-great-great-grandniece of John Wilkes Booth. And in both cases, they've been trying to get the bodies of Meriwether Lewis and John Wilkes Booth exhumed for a very long time. And in both cases, the family's wishes, usually in exhumations, the family wishes are what is the reason whether anything happens or not. That's the first and foremost concern, is does the family want it? But in these cases, in both cases, they've been blocked.
Hmm.
And by the National Park Service, the government, and so forth. And there's good reason for that, because there's legitimate concern. Meriwether Lewis most probably was murdered. I don't think he killed himself. Exhumation may show that. In John Wilkes Booth's case, more importantly, many people believe the body buried in Green Mount Cemetery is not John Wilkes Booth. Well, and that he actually went, he didn't die at Garrett's Farm, and he went on to live several decades. Finus Bates wrote a book about that in the 19th century. So, but how many court historians have smeared people who have said this over the decades, over the century? So what happens if there's, again, there have such a vested interest? It's a pride thing. We see that today in some of the old reporters that are left from the JFK assassination. They're not going to admit they got it wrong. They have a pride in this, so they don't want to ever admit. So if they exhume that body and it's not John Wilkes Booth, DNA evidence shows that, they're not going to apologize. What are they going to do? They're going to be left with such egg on their faces. So that's why I think I have no respect for these court historians, because, first of all, they won't ever admit they're wrong. They are arrogant beyond belief. If you watch these guys on television, any historian, any tenured historian that you see on a show on the History Channel pretty much just shows American pickers and nonsense like that all the time. But the rare occasions when they have a show about history on the History Channel or something, these guys, to a person, whether they're male or female, the smugness and the arrogance that comes out of them is just beyond belief. They are just so certain with their little fairy tales that actually are fly in the face of all the evidence. But so it's very difficult. And certainly Thomas DiLorenzo ran up to the gap, because the Lincoln cult actually paid attention to him, because his book sold so well. So mine will sell well enough that they'll have to pay attention to me. But the smugness and the way they dismiss people like that is mind-boggling. These people are never going to admit that they were wrong, and they're the ones that can. And so hopefully there are going to be more historians like me out there that'll be kind of a people's historian, where it would be something where I don't have an agenda. I mean, I'm trying to write about the facts. I do have a worldview. I do tend to be very skeptical and cynical, and I think corruption has ruled the day for pretty much most of human history. So I do look for that. Hopefully I would be more willing to admit my errors than the average court historian would.
Well, I, you know, it's I know Hitler died in the bunker because I saw Hitler's Last 10 Days with Anthony Hopkins. Or, you know.
That's right. That's right. And you're all doing that.
And things were all wedded to that story because it's a great story. A fitting end, you know, to this dictator who conquered Europe, ending up, you know, ensconced in a bunker, living a life of a troglodyte in the final days, going in these rages. How do we know that's true?
Exactly.
You know, so we become married to these things. This is an image, you know, the same thing, you know, so same thing. It's hard to, and what gets me is a lot of these historians that are, you know, they're more than a century removed from these events. And they're not willing to entertain the idea that maybe they were misled.
Exactly.
No. As you say, what, political leaders are never killed for political reasons.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so when you write this stuff, you publish these books, are you still the crazy uncle?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't get a whole lot of attention. I think that, yeah, really, after the first couple books, I think, yeah, it's just... It really does. Yeah, it is what it is. You know, there's not a whole lot of people that know me. Most of my fans and the people that pay attention to my writing are people I don't know.
It's the only respect I get from people who don't know me. I like
that. Exactly. Pretty much. Yeah.
Well, I just tell people to read the book and just go through the evidence and just read other books. And that's how I've developed these views. I kind of like I'm not definite about these things, but yeah, you got to read.
You know. So much, you know, in the case of my family, they've heard, I mean, I've been ranting and raving about things for forever. So they've heard these discussions with my friends at parties and family get-togethers where I'll expound. And, you know, I may not go as deep into history as I do here, but I've talked about many of these issues. So it may be old hat to them. Oh, yeah. I mean, they pretty much know what I think, I guess. And, so I think that's what happens where and people even told me when my first novel was published, everybody that knew me said, you know, I couldn't read it because I kept hearing your voice, you know, was right. So I guess there maybe is a problem. If you know the person, you know, it's different. But, you know, fortunately.
Well, Hitler's death, right?
Yeah.
The story of him committing suicide, him and Eva Braun, I guess, him taking cyanide and taking a bullet to his head and.
Right.
These things, you know, killing his dog and all these things.
Right.
Other Nazis supposedly committed suicide, like Goebbels and his kids, and hear these stories.
Right.
Let's assume that's true. You know,
he
killed his 10 kids or something. Yeah.
Right.
Is that more believable than him escaping? Wouldn't you? Because we're always told that it's amazing that he stayed in Berlin and these things.
Well, the first thing I write, you know, especially if the establishment view of Hitler is correct. This is a megalomaniac. This is a drama queen like none other.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have left a suicide note to the world? I mean, there's no suicide note behind. Same thing with Marilyn Monroe. You go, somebody like a drama queen like that, she would kill herself without leaving a suicide note? Come on. You have to understand personalities.
Well, that's nothing. You read about these accounts and that Marilyn Monroe's death, so obviously she wasn't suicide.
Right, exactly.
Just based on the evidence, you know.
Exactly.
You know, the pills weren't swallowed.
No, I mean
they were inserted, you know, into the other end, and that doesn't make any sense if she's committing suicide. But you point these things out, and it's like, you're like,
well, you scratch the surface of. I mean, really, any event that has any significance at all, and it doesn't take much investigation. Just read the news accounts, see how it doesn't add up, and listen to the witnesses that aren't listened to, and it's like, okay, well, they lied again. So you just assume that I assume about anything from history up until any present event, current event today, I assume they're lying.
Another thing is if you look at like with Hitler, if you take in the account of the Bormann capital flight that occurred, the negotiation that is supposed to be occurring in late 1944, the Red House meeting, I think, Maison Rouge meeting in July or August 1944, when there was the Allied breakout and the Third Reich knew it was kaput.
Right.
So he organizes all this financial dealings with the Allies, with trading secrets and these things, negotiating these things under the table. You have Alan Dulles, you know, meeting with SS Wolf in Switzerland, working all types of deals with the paperclip. Mm-hmm. And you have, what's his name? Galen, the Galen Network, which is integrated into the CIA, OSS and CIA. They formed the Soviet desk. Given that context, it's perfectly reasonable to suspect that some deal was worked out, for Hitler. You know.
Sure. He played his part, and then he was just whisked off the stage. Sure.
You know, and then the fog machine or the illusion machine kicks in. The wartime prop, all the information is controlled, essentially controlled during the war, even after the war, because that's, you know, our major media grew out of the OSS and
right.
Office of War Information.
Sure.
All these guys that were involved in propaganda, many of the people right. that showed up at the camps and they made the films about the concentration camps, these guys were all psychological warfare experts and Hollywood right. directors, by the way.
Right. Exactly.
So take from that what you will.
Right.
You know, so it is. It's an illusion machine. And,
right.
and they're going to control the narrative, and they have the means to do it, and they will do it.
Yep.
Particularly with the magic of, you know, of the projecting of the camera.
Right, right.
You know, and so we have to, you know, good example. I mean, how many times have people seen CNN faking the Gulf War right. missile attack?
Exactly. Yeah.
So if they're you doing that there, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, that's all I ask. Look at this. Yeah. And how can you go back and watch, see what you watch in the news and just presume that it's accurate or truthful? That's ridiculous.
Exactly. It sure
at
is.
At this point. Well, it's a great book, Don. So it's going to be due out next month?
I think so. Right now it's saying June 18th, so hopefully it'll be accurate. But it's going to be pre-ordered now, so it's out there.
Okay. So on Amazon and all the...
Yep. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the other places. Yep.
Excellent. Okay. Sorry, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963?
That's right.
Okay, that's the title. And your podcast is I Protest on the Truth Frequency Network?
I Protest every Friday, 5 to 7. Yeah, you can find me on TFR, and I'll have the archive broadcasts that I think are available to the public for a few weeks at least, okay. I think. But, yep.
Anywhere else people can follow your work?
My blog, donaldjeffries.wordpress.com, keeping it unreal. I write regularly there about issues and, you know, so people can keep up with my latest rants there.
Okay, great. Okay, listen, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, Tim, for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'll let you go, and you have a nice evening then.
Thanks, you too. Take care, Tim. Okay, bye.